It would never be her house now. Ashley would never carry her over the threshold as his bride. Oh, Ashley. Ashley. What have I done? Deep in her, under layers of hurt pride and cold practicality, something stirred hurtingly. An adult emotion was being born, stronger than her vanity or her willful selfishness. She loved Ashley, and she knew she loved him. And she had never cared so much as in that instant when she saw Charles disappearing around the curved, graveled walk.
Chapter 7. Within 2 weeks, Scarlett had become a wife, and within 2 months more, she was a widow. She was soon released from the bond she had assumed with so much haste and so little thought, but she was never again to know the careless freedom of her unmarried days. Widowhood had crowded closely on the heels of marriage, but to her dismay, motherhood soon followed. In after years, when she thought of those last days of April 1861, Scarlett could never quite remember details. Time and events were telescoped, jumbled together like a nightmare that had no reality or reason. Till the day she died, there would be blank spots in her memories of those days. Especially vague were her recollections of the time between her acceptance of Charles and her wedding. 2 weeks. So short an engagement would have been impossible in times of peace. Then there would have been a decorous interval of a year or at least 6 months. But the South was aflame with war. Events roared along as swiftly as if carried by a mighty wind, and the slow tempo of the old days was gone. Ellen had wrung her hands and counseled delay, in order that Scarlett might think the matter over at greater length. But to her pleadings, Scarlett turned a sullen face and a deaf ear. Marry she would, and quickly, too, within 2 weeks. Learning that Ashley's wedding had been moved up from the autumn to the first day of May, so he could leave with a troop as soon as it was called into service, Scarlett set the date of her wedding for the day before his. Ellen protested, but Charles pleaded with newfound eloquence, for he was impatient to be off to South Carolina to join Wade Hampton's legion, and Gerald sided with the two young people. He was excited by the war fever, and pleased that Scarlett had made so good a match. And who was he to stand in the way of young love when there was a war? Ellen, distracted, finally gave in, as other mothers throughout the South were doing. Their leisured world had been turned topsy-turvy, and their pleadings, prayers, and advice availed nothing against the powerful forces sweeping them along. The South was intoxicated with enthusiasm and excitement. Everyone knew that one battle would end the war, and every young man hastened to enlist before the war should end. Hastened to marry his sweetheart before he rushed off to Virginia to strike a blow at the Yankees. There were dozens of war weddings in the county, and there was little time for the sorrow of parting, for everyone was too busy and excited for either solemn thoughts or tears. The ladies were making uniforms, knitting socks, and rolling bandages, and the men were drilling and shooting. Trainloads of troops passed through Jonesboro daily on their way north to Atlanta and Virginia. Some detachments were gaily uniformed in the scarlets and light blues and greens of select social militia companies. Some small groups were in homespun and coonskin caps. Others, ununiformed, were in broadcloth and fine linen. All were half-drilled, half-armed, wild with excitement and shouting as though en route to a picnic. The sight of these men threw the county boys into a panic for fear the war would be over before they could reach Virginia, and preparations for the troops' departure were speeded. In the midst of this turmoil, preparations went forward for Scarlett's wedding, and almost before she knew it, she was clad in Ellen's wedding dress and veil, coming down the wide stairs of Tara on her father's arm to face a house packed full with guests. Afterward, she remembered, as from a dream, the hundreds of candles flaring on the walls, her mother's face, loving, a little bewildered, her lips moving in a silent prayer for her daughter's happiness. Gerald flushed with brandy and pride that his daughter was marrying both money, a fine name, and an old one. And Ashley, standing at the bottom of the steps with Melanie's arm through his. When she saw the look on his face, she thought, "This can't be real. It can't be. It's a nightmare. I'll wake up and find it's all been a nightmare. I mustn't think of it now, or I'll begin screaming in front of all these people. I can't think of it now. I'll think later, when I can stand it. When I can't see his eyes." It was all very dreamlike. The passage through the aisle of smiling people. Charles's scarlet face and stammering voice and her own replies, so startlingly clear, so cold. And the congratulations afterward, and the kissing, and the toasts, and the dancing, all like a dream. Even the feel of Ashley's kiss upon her cheek, even Melanie's soft whisper, "Now we are really and truly sisters," were unreal. Even the excitement caused by the swooning spell that overtook Charles's plump, emotional aunt, Miss Pittypat Hamilton, had the quality of a nightmare. But when the dancing and toasting were finally ended and the dawn was coming, when all the Atlanta guests who could be crowded into Terra and the overseer's house had gone to sleep on beds, sofas and pallets on the floor, and all the neighbors had gone home to rest in preparation for the wedding at 12 Oaks the next day, then the dreamlike trance shattered like crystal before reality. The reality was the blushing Charles, emerging from her dressing room in his nightshirt, avoiding the startled look she gave him over the high-pulled sheet. Of course, she knew that married people occupied the same bed, but she had never given the matter a thought before. It seemed very natural in the case of her mother and father, but she had never applied it to herself. Now, for the first time since the barbecue, she realized just what she had brought on herself. The thought of this strange boy whom she hadn't really wanted to marry getting into bed with her, when her heart was breaking with an agony of regret at her hasty action and the anguish of losing Ashley forever, was too much to be borne. As he hesitatingly approached the bed, she spoke in a hoarse whisper. "I'll scream out loud if you come near me. I will. I will. At the top of my voice, get away from me. Don't you dare touch me." So Charles Hamilton spent his wedding night in an armchair in the corner. Not too unhappily, for he understood, or thought he understood, the modesty and delicacy of his bride. He was willing to wait until her fears subsided, only. He sighed as he twisted about seeking a comfortable position, for he was going away to the war so very soon. Nightmarish as her own wedding had been, Ashley's wedding was even worse. Scarlett stood in her apple-green second-day dress in the parlor of 12 Oaks, amid the blaze of hundreds of candles, jostled by the same throng as the night before, and saw the plain little face of Melanie Hamilton glow into beauty as she became Melanie Wilkes. Now Ashley was gone forever. Her Ashley. No, not her Ashley now. Had he ever been hers? It was all so mixed up in her mind, and her mind was so tired, so bewildered. He had said he loved her, but what was it that had separated them? If she could only remember. She had stilled the county's gossiping tongue by marrying Charles, but what did that matter now? It had seemed so important once, but now it didn't seem important at all. All that mattered was Ashley. Now he was gone, and she was married to a man she not only did not love, but for whom she had an active contempt. Oh, how she regretted it all. She had often heard of people cutting off their noses to spite their faces, but heretofore it had been only a figure of speech. Now she knew just what it meant. And mingled with her frenzied desire to be free of Charles, and safely back at Terra, an unmarried girl again, ran the knowledge that she had only herself to blame. Ellen had tried to stop her, and she would not listen. So she danced through the night of Ashley's wedding in a daze, and said things mechanically, and smiled, and irrelevantly wondered at the stupidity of people who thought her a happy bride, and who could not see that her heart was broken. Well, thank God they couldn't see. That night, after Mammy had helped her undress, and had departed, and Charles had emerged shyly from the dressing room, wondering if he was to spend a second night in the horsehair chair, she burst into tears. She cried until Charles climbed into bed beside her and tried to comfort her. Cried without words, until no more tears would come, and at last she lay sobbing quietly on his shoulder. If there had not been a war, there would have been a week of visiting about the county, with balls and barbecues in honor of the two newly married couples, before they set off to Saratoga or White Sulphur for wedding trips. If there had not been a war, Scarlet would have had third day and fourth day and fifth day dresses to wear to the Fontaine and Calvert and Tarleton parties in her honor. But there were no parties now, and no wedding trips. A week after the wedding, Charles left to join Colonel Wade Hampton, and 2 weeks later, Ashley and the troop departed, leaving the whole county bereft. In those 2 weeks, Scarlet never saw Ashley alone, never had a private word with him, not even at the terrible moment of parting, when he stopped by Tara on his way to the train, did she have a private talk. Melanie, bonneted and shawled, sedate in newly acquired matronly dignity, hung on his arm, and the entire personnel of Tara, black and white, turned out to see Ashley off to the war. Melanie said, "You must kiss Scarlet, Ashley. She's my sister now." And Ashley bent and touched her cheek with cold lips, his face drawn and taut. Scarlet could hardly take any joy from that kiss, so sullen was her heart at Melly's prompting it. Melanie smothered her with an embrace at parting. "You will come to Atlanta and visit me and Aunt Pittypat, won't you? Oh, darling, we want to have you so much. We want to know Charlie's wife better." 5 weeks passed during which letters, shy, ecstatic, loving, came from Charles in South Carolina telling of his love, his plans for the future when the war was over, his desire to become a hero for her sake, and his worship of his commander, Wade Hampton. In the 7th week, there came a telegram from Colonel Hampton himself, and then a letter, a kind, dignified letter of condolence. Charles was dead. The colonel would have wired earlier, but Charles, thinking his illness a trifling one, did not wish to have his family worried. The unfortunate boy had not only been cheated of the love he thought he had won, but also of his high hopes of honor and glory on the field of battle. He had died ignominiously and swiftly of pneumonia, following measles, without ever having gotten any closer to the Yankees than the camp in South Carolina. In due time, Charles' son was born, and because it was fashionable to name boys after their father's commanding officers, he was called Wade Hampton Hamilton. Scarlet had wept with despair at the knowledge that she was pregnant, and wished that she were dead. But she carried the child through its time with a minimum of discomfort, bore him with little distress, and recovered so quickly that Mammy told her privately it was downright common. Ladies should suffer more. She felt little affection for the child, hide the fact though she might. She had not wanted him, and she resented his coming, and now that he was here, it did not seem possible that he was hers, a part of her. Though she recovered physically from Wade's birth in a disgracefully short time, mentally she was dazed and sick. Her spirits drooped, despite the efforts of the whole plantation to revive them. Ellen went about with a puckered, worried forehead, and Gerald swore more frequently than usual, and brought her useless gifts from Jonesboro. Even old Dr. Fontaine admitted that he was puzzled, after his tonic of sulphur, molasses, and herbs failed to perk her up. He told Ellen privately that it was a broken heart that made Scarlet so irritable and listless by turns. But Scarlet, had she wished to speak, could have told them that it was a far different and more complex trouble. She did not tell them that it was utter boredom, bewilderment at actually being a mother, and most of all, the absence of Ashley that made her look so woebegone. Her boredom was acute and ever-present. The county had been devoid of any entertainment or social life ever since the troop had gone away to war. All of the interesting young men were gone. The four Charltons, the two Calverts, the Fontaines, the Munroes, and everyone from Jonesboro, Fayetteville, and Lovejoy, who was young and attractive. Only the older men, the cripples, and the women were left, and they spent their time knitting and sewing, growing more cotton and corn, raising more hogs and sheep and cows for the army. There was never a sight of a real man except when the commissary troop, under Sue Ellen's middle-aged beau, Frank Kennedy, rode by every month to collect supplies. The men in the commissary were not very exciting, and the sight of Frank's timid courting annoyed her until she found it difficult to be polite to him. If he and Sue Ellen would only get it over with. Even if the commissary troop had been more interesting, it would not have helped her situation any. She was a widow, and her heart was in the grave. At least, everyone thought it was in the grave and expected her to act accordingly. This irritated her, for try as she could recall nothing about Charles except the dying calf look on his face when she told him she would marry him. And even that picture was fading. But she was a widow, and she had to watch her behavior. Not for her the pleasures of unmarried girls. She had to be grave and aloof. Ellen had stressed this at great length, after catching Frank's lieutenant swinging Scarlet in the garden swing and making her squeal with laughter. Deeply distressed, Ellen had told her how easily a widow might get herself talked about. The conduct of a widow must be twice as circumspect as that of a matron. "And God only knows," thought Scarlet, listening obediently to her mother's soft voice. "Matrons never have any fun at all. So widows might as well be dead." A widow had to wear hideous black dresses without even a touch of braid to enliven them. No flower or ribbon or lace or even jewelry, except onyx mourning brooches or necklaces made from the deceased's hair. And the black crepe veil on her bonnet had to reach to her knees. And only after 3 years of widowhood could it be shortened to shoulder length. Widows could never chatter vivaciously or laugh aloud. Even when they smiled, it must be a sad, tragic smile. And most dreadful of all, they could in no way indicate an interest in the company of gentlemen. And should a gentleman be so ill-bred as to indicate an interest in her, she must freeze him with a dignified but well-chosen reference to her dead husband. "Oh, yes," thought Scarlet drearily, "some widows do remarry eventually, when they are old and stringy. Though heaven knows how they manage it, with their neighbors watching. And then it's generally to some desperate old widower with a large plantation and a dozen children. Marriage was bad enough, but to be widowed, oh, then life was over forever. How stupid people were when they talked about what a comfort little Wade Hampton must be to her, now that Charles was gone. How stupid of them to say that now she had something to live for. Everyone talked about how sweet it was that she had this posthumous token of her love, and she naturally did not disabuse their minds. But that thought was farthest from her mind. She had very little interest in Wade, and sometimes it was difficult to remember that he was actually hers. Every morning she woke up, and for a drowsy moment she was Scarlet O'Hara again, and the sun was bright in the magnolia outside her window, and the mockers were singing, and the sweet smell of frying bacon was stealing to her nostrils. She was carefree and young again. Then she heard the fretful, hungry wail, and always, always there was a startled moment when she thought, "Why, there's a baby in the house." Then she remembered that it was her baby. It was all very bewildering. And Ashley. Oh, most of all, Ashley. For the first time in her life, she hated Tara. Hated the long red road that led down the hill to the river. Hated the red fields with springing green cotton. Every foot of ground, every tree and brook, every lane and bridle path reminded her of him. He belonged to another woman, and he had gone to the war. But his ghost still haunted the roads in the twilight, still smiled at her from drowsy gray eyes in the shadows of the porch. She never heard the sound of hooves coming up the river road from 12 Oaks, that for a sweet moment she did not think, Ashley! She hated 12 Oaks now, and once she had loved it. She hated it, but she was drawn there, so she could hear John Wilkes and the girls talk about him, hear them read his letters from Virginia. They hurt her, but she had to hear them. She disliked the stiff-necked India and the foolish prattling Honey, and knew they disliked her equally, but she could not stay away from them. And every time she came home from 12 Oaks, she lay down on her bed morosely and refused to get up for supper. It was this refusal of food that worried Ellen and Mammy more than anything else. Mammy brought up tempting trays, insinuating that now that she was a widow she might eat as much as she pleased. But Scarlet had no appetite. When Dr. Fontaine told Ellen gravely that heartbreak frequently led to a decline, and women pined away into the grave, Ellen went white, for that fear was what she had carried in her heart. "Isn't there anything to be done, Doctor?"
"A change of scene will be the best thing in the world for her," said the doctor, only too anxious to be rid of an unsatisfactory patient.
So Scarlet, unenthusiastic, went off with her child first to visit her O'Hara and Robillard relatives in Savannah, and then to Ellen's sisters, Pauline and Eulalie, in Charleston. But she was back at Tara a month before Ellen expected her, with no explanation of her return. They had been kind in Savannah, but James and Andrew and their wives were old and content to sit quietly and talk of a past in which Scarlet had no interest. It was the same with the Robillards, and Charleston was terrible, Scarlet thought. Aunt Pauline and her husband, a little old man with a formal brittle courtesy, and the absent heir of one living in an older age, lived on a plantation on the river, far more isolated than Tara. Their nearest neighbor was 20 miles away by dark roads, through still jungles of cypress swamp and oak. The live oaks, with their waving curtains of gray moss, gave Scarlet the creeps, and always brought to her mind Gerald's stories of Irish ghosts roaming in shimmering gray mists. There was nothing to do but knit all day, and at night listen to Uncle Carrie read aloud from the improving works of Mr. Bulwer Lytton. Eulalie, hidden behind a high-walled garden in a great house on the Battery in Charleston, was no more entertaining. Scarlet, accustomed to wide vistas of rolling red hills, felt that she was in prison. There was more social life here than at Aunt Pauline's, but Scarlet did not like the people who called, with their airs and their traditions and their emphasis on family. She knew very well they all thought she was a child of a mésalliance, and wondered how a Robillard ever married a newly-come Irishman. Scarlet felt that Aunt Eulalie apologized for her behind her back. This aroused her temper, for she cared no more about family than her father. She was proud of Gerald and what he had accomplished unaided, except by his shrewd Irish brain. And the Charlestonians took so much upon themselves about Fort Sumter. Good heavens! Didn't they realize that if they hadn't been silly enough to fire the shot that started the war, some other fools would have done it? Accustomed to the brisk voices of upland Georgia, the drawling, flat voices of the Low Country seemed affected to her. She thought if she ever again heard voices that said "palms" for palms, and "hoose" for house, and "woont" for won't, and "ma" and "pa" for ma and pa, she would scream. It irritated her so much that during one formal call she ate Gerald's brogue to her aunt's distress. Then she went back to Tara. Better to be tormented with memories of Ashley than Charleston accents. Ellen, busy night and day,
doubling the productiveness of Tara to aid the Confederacy, was terrified when her eldest daughter came home from Charleston, thin, white, and sharp-tongued. She had known heartbreak herself, and night after night she lay beside the snoring Gerald, trying to think of some way to lessen Scarlett's distress. Charles's aunt, Miss Pittipat Hamilton, had written her several times, urging her to permit Scarlett to come to Atlanta for a long visit. And now, for the first time, Ellen considered it seriously. She and Melanie were alone in a big house, and without male protection, wrote Miss Pittipat, now that dear Charlie has gone. Of course, there is my brother Henry, but he does not make his home with us. But perhaps Scarlett has told you of Henry. Delicacy forbids my putting more concerning him on paper. Melly and I would feel so much easier and safer if Scarlett were with us. Three lonely women are better than two. And perhaps dear Scarlett could find some ease for her sorrow, as Melanie is doing, by nursing our brave boys in the hospitals here. And, of course, Melly and I are longing to see the dear baby. So Scarlett's trunk was packed again, with her morning clothes. And off she went to Atlanta with Wade Hampton and his nurse, Prissy, a head full of admonitions as to her conduct from Ellen and Mammy, and $100 in Confederate bills from Gerald. She did not especially want to go to Atlanta. She thought Aunt Pittipat the silliest of old ladies, and the very idea of living under the same roof with Ashley's wife was abhorrent. But the county, with its memories, was impossible now, and any change was welcome. Part 2. Chapter 8. As the train carried Scarlett northward that May morning in 1862, she thought that Atlanta couldn't possibly be so boring as Charleston and Savannah had been. And in spite of her distaste for Miss Pittipat and Melanie, she looked forward with some curiosity toward seeing how the town had fared since her last visit, in the winter before the war began. Atlanta had always interested her more than any other town, because when she was a child, Gerald had told her that she and Atlanta were exactly the same age. She discovered when she grew older that Gerald had stretched the truth somewhat, as was his habit when a little stretching would improve a story. But Atlanta was only 9 years older than she was, and that still left the place amazingly young by comparison with any other town she had ever heard of. Savannah and Charleston had the dignity of their years, one being well along in its second century and the other entering its third. And in her young eyes, they had always seemed like aged grandmothers fanning themselves placidly in the sun. But Atlanta was of her own generation, crude with the crudities of youth, and as headstrong and impetuous as herself. The story Gerald had told her was based on the fact that she and Atlanta were christened in the same year. In the 9 years before Scarlett was born, the town had been called first Terminus, and then Marthasville, and not until the year of Scarlett's birth had it become Atlanta. When Gerald first moved to North Georgia, there had been no Atlanta at all, not even the semblance of a village, and wilderness rolled over the site. But the next year, in 1836, the state had authorized the building of a railroad northwestward through the territory which the Cherokees had recently ceded. The destination of the proposed railroad, Tennessee and the West, was clear and definite. But its beginning point in Georgia was somewhat uncertain until, a year later, an engineer drove a stake in the red clay to mark the southern end of the line, and Atlanta, born Terminus, had begun. There were no railroads then in North Georgia, and very few anywhere else. But during the years before Gerald married Ellen, the tiny settlement 25 miles north of Tara slowly grew into a village, and the track slowly pushed northward. Then the railroad building era really began. From the old city of Augusta, a second railroad was extended westward across the state to connect with a new road to Tennessee.
From the old city of Savannah, a third railroad was built first to Macon, in the heart of Georgia, and then north through Gerald's own county to Atlanta, to link up with the other two roads and give Savannah's harbor a highway to the west. From the same junction point, the Young Atlanta, a fourth railroad was constructed southwestward to Montgomery and Mobile. Born of a railroad, Atlanta grew as its railroads grew. With the completion of the four lines, Atlanta was now connected with the west, with the south, with the coast, and through Augusta, with the north and east. It had become the crossroads of travel north and south and east and west. And the little village leaped to life. In a space of time but little longer than Scarlett's 17 years, Atlanta had grown from a single stake driven in the ground into a thriving small city of 10,000 that was the center of attention for the whole state. The older, quieter cities were wont to look upon the bustling new town with the sensations of a hen which has hatched a duckling. Why was the place so different from the other Georgia towns? Why did it grow so fast? After all, they thought, it had nothing whatever to recommend it, only its railroads and a bunch of mighty pushy people. The people who settled the town, called successively Terminus, Marthasville, and Atlanta, were a pushy people. Restless, energetic people from the older sections of Georgia and from more distant states were drawn to this town that sprawled itself around the junction of the railroads in its center. They came with enthusiasm. They built their stores around the five muddy red roads that crossed near the depot. They built their fine homes on Whitehall and Washington streets, and along the high ridge of land on which countless generations of moccasined Indian feet had beaten a path called the Peachtree Trail. They were proud of the place, proud of its growth, proud of themselves for making it grow. Let the older towns call Atlanta anything they pleased. Atlanta did not care. Scarlett had always liked Atlanta for the very same reasons that made Savannah, Augusta, and Macon condemn it. Like herself, the town was a mixture of the old and new in Georgia, in which the old often came off second best in its conflicts with the self-willed and vigorous new. Moreover, there was something personal, exciting about a town that was born, or at least christened, the same year she was christened. The night before had been wild and wet with rain. But when Scarlett arrived in Atlanta, a warm sun was at work, bravely attempting to dry the streets that were winding rivers of red mud. In the open space around the depot, the soft ground had been cut and churned by the constant flow of traffic in and out, until it resembled an enormous hog wallow, and here and there vehicles were mired to the hubs in the ruts. An ever-ceasing line of army wagons and ambulances, loading and unloading supplies and wounded from the trains, made the mud and confusion worse as they toiled in and struggled out, drivers swearing, mules plunging and mud spattering for yards. Scarlett stood on the lower step of the train, a pale, pretty figure in her black mourning dress, her crepe veil fluttering almost to her heels. She hesitated, unwilling to soil her slippers and hems, and looked about in the shouting tangle of wagons, buggies, and carriages for Miss Pittypat. There was no sign of that chubby, pink-cheeked lady, but as Scarlett searched anxiously, a spare old negro with grizzled kinks and an air of dignified authority came toward her through the mud, his hat in his hand.
"'Dis Miss Scarlett, ain't it? "'Dis yere, Peter, Miss Pitty's coachman.' "'Don't step down in dat mud,' he ordered severely.
As Scarlett gathered up her skirts, preparatory to descending.
"'You is as bad as Miss Pitty, and she like a child about gittin' her feet sweat. Lemme care you.'
He picked Scarlett up with ease, despite his apparent frailness and age, and, observing Prissy standing on the platform of the train, the baby in her arms, He paused.
"Is that a child your nurse?" "Miss Scarlet, she too young to be handling Mr. Charles' onlyest baby. But we tend to that later. You, gal, follow me, and don't you go dropping that baby."
Scarlet submitted meekly to being carried toward the carriage, and also to the peremptory manner in which Uncle Peter criticized her and Prissy. As they went through the mud with Prissy sloshing, pouting after them, she recalled what Charles had said about Uncle Peter.
"He went through all the Mexican campaigns with Father, nursed him when he was wounded. In fact, he saved his life. Uncle Peter practically raised Millie and me, for we were very young when Father and Mother died. Aunt Pitty had a falling out with her brother, Uncle Henry, about that time, so she came to live with us and take care of us. She is the most helpless soul, just like a sweet grown-up child, and Uncle Peter treats her that way. To save her life, she couldn't make up her mind about anything, so Peter makes it up for her. He was the one who decided I should have a larger allowance when I was 15, and he insisted that I should go to Harvard for my senior year, when Uncle Henry wanted me to take my degree at the university. And he decided when Melly was old enough to put up her hair and go to parties. He tells Aunt Pitty when it's too cold or too wet for her to go calling, and when she should wear a shawl. He's the smartest old ducky I've ever seen, and about the most devoted. The only trouble with him is that he owns the three of us, body and soul, and he knows it."
Charles' words were confirmed as Peter climbed onto the box and took the whip.
"Miss Pitty in a state because she didn't come to meet you. She's feared you might not understand, but I told her she and Miss Millie just get splashed with mud and ruined their new dresses, and I explained to you. Miss Scarlet, you better take that child, that little pickaninny, gwine let it drop."
Scarlet looked at Prissy and sighed. Prissy was not the most adequate of nurses. Her recent graduation from a skinny pickaninny with brief skirts and stiffly wrapped braids into the dignity of a long calico dress and starched white turban was an intoxicating affair. She would never have arrived at this eminence so early in life had not the exigencies of war and the demands of the commissary department on Terra made it impossible for Ellen to spare Mammy or Dilsey or even Rosa or Tina. Prissy had never been more than a mile away from Twelve Oaks or Tara before, and the trip on the train, plus her elevation to nurse, was almost more than the brain in her little black skull could bear. The 20-mile journey from Jonesboro to Atlanta had so excited her that Scarlet had been forced to hold the baby all the way. Now the sight of so many buildings and people completed Prissy's demoralization. She twisted from side to side, pointed, bounced about, and so jaunced the baby that he wailed miserably. Scarlet longed for the fat old arms of Mammy. Mammy had only to lay hands on a child, and it hushed crying. But Mammy was at Terra, and there was nothing Scarlet could do. It was useless for her to take little Wade from Prissy. He yelled just as loudly when she held him as when Prissy did. Besides, he would tug at the ribbons of her bonnet and, no doubt, rumple her dress. So she pretended she had not heard Uncle Peter's suggestion. "Maybe I'll learn about babies sometime," she thought irritably, as the carriage jolted and swayed out of the morass surrounding the station. "But I'm never going to like fooling with them." And as Wade's face went purple with his squalling, she snapped crossly. "Give him that sugar tit in your pocket, Pris. Anything to make him hush. I know he's hungry, but I can't do anything about that now." Prissy produced the sugar tit, given her that morning by Mammy, and the baby's wails subsided. With quiet restored, and with the new sights that met her eyes, Scarlet's spirits began to rise a little. When Uncle Peter finally maneuvered the carriage out of the mud holes and onto Peachtree Street, she felt the first surge of interest she had known in months.
How the town had grown!
It was not much more than a year since she had last been here, and it did not seem possible that the little Atlanta she knew could have changed so much. For the past year she had been so engrossed in her own woes, so bored by any mention of war. She didn't know that from the minute the fighting first began, Atlanta had been transformed. The same railroads which had made the town the crossroads of commerce in time of peace were now of vital strategic importance in time of war. Far from the battle lines, the town and its railroads provided the connecting link between the two armies of the Confederacy, the army in Virginia, and the army in Tennessee and the West. And Atlanta likewise linked both of the armies with the deeper South from which they drew their supplies. Now, in response to the needs of war, Atlanta had become a manufacturing center, a hospital base, and one of the South's chief depots for the collecting of food and supplies for the armies in the field. Scarlet looked about her for the little town she remembered so well. It was gone. The town she was now seeing was like a baby grown overnight into a busy, sprawling giant. Atlanta was humming like a beehive, proudly conscious of its importance to the Confederacy. And work was going forward night and day toward turning an agricultural section into an industrial one. Before the war, there had been few cotton factories, woolen mills, arsenals, and machine shops south of Maryland, a fact of which all Southerners were proud. The South produced statesmen and soldiers, planters and doctors, lawyers and poets, but certainly not engineers or mechanics. Let the Yankees adopt such low callings. But now the Confederate ports were stoppered with Yankee gunboats. Only a trickle of blockade-run goods was slipping in from Europe, and the South was desperately trying to manufacture her own war materials. The North could call on the whole world for supplies and for soldiers, and thousands of Irish and Germans were pouring into the Union Army, lured by the bounty money offered by the North. The South could only turn in upon itself. In Atlanta, there were machine factories tediously turning out machinery to manufacture war materials. Tediously, because there were few machines in the South from which they could model, and nearly every wheel and cog had to be made from drawings that came through the blockade from England. There were strange faces on the streets of Atlanta now, and citizens who a year ago would have pricked up their ears at the sound of even a Western accent paid no heed to the foreign tongues of Europeans, who had run the blockade to build machines and turn out Confederate munitions. Skilled men, these, without whom the Confederacy would have been hard put to make pistols, rifles, cannon, and powder. Almost the pulsing of the town's heart could be felt as the work went forward night and day, pumping the materials of war up the railway arteries to the two battlefronts. Trains roared in and out of town at all hours. Soot from the newly erected factories fell in showers on the white houses. By night, the furnaces glowed and the hammers clanged long after townsfolk were abed. Where vacant lots had been a year before, there were now factories turning out harness, saddles and shoes, ordnance supply plants making rifles and cannon, rolling mills and foundries producing iron rails and freight cars to replace those destroyed by the Yankees, and a variety of industries manufacturing spurs, bridle bits, buckles, tents, buttons, pistols, and swords. Already the foundries were beginning to feel the lack of iron, for little or none came through the blockade, and the mines in Alabama were standing almost idle while the miners were at the front. There were no iron picket fences, iron summer houses, iron gates, or even iron statuary on the lawns of Atlanta now, for they had early found their way into the melting pots of the rolling mills. Here along Peachtree Street and nearby streets were the headquarters of the various army departments, each office swarming with uniformed men, the commissary, the signal corps, the mail service, the railway transport, the provost marshal. On the outskirts of town
were the remount depots where horses and mules milled about in large corrals, and along side streets were the hospitals. As Uncle Peter told her about them, Scarlet felt that Atlanta must be a city of the wounded. For there were general hospitals, contagious hospitals, convalescent hospitals without number. And every day the trains just below Five Points disgorged more sick and more wounded. The little town was gone, and the face of the rapidly growing city was animated with never-ceasing energy and bustle. The sight of so much hurrying made Scarlet, fresh from rural leisure and quiet, almost breathless. But she liked it. There was an exciting atmosphere about the place that uplifted her. It was as if she could actually feel the accelerated, steady pulse of the town's heart beating in time with her own. As they slowly made their way through the mud holes of the town's chief street, she noted with interest all the new buildings and the new faces. The sidewalks were crowded with men in uniform, bearing the insignia of all ranks and all service branches. The narrow street was jammed with vehicles, carriages, buggies, ambulances, covered army wagons with profane drivers swearing as the mules struggled through the ruts. Gray-clad couriers dashed spattering through the streets from one headquarters to another, bearing orders and telegraphic dispatches. Convalescents limped about on crutches, usually with a solicitous lady at either elbow. Bugle and drum and barked orders sounded from the drill fields where the recruits were being turned into soldiers. And with her heart in her throat, Scarlet had her first sight of Yankee uniforms, as Uncle Peter pointed with his whip to a detachment of dejected-looking bluecoats being shepherded toward the depot by a squad of Confederates with fixed bayonets to entrain for the prison camp. Oh, thought Scarlet, with the first feeling of real pleasure she had experienced since the day of the barbecue. I'm going to like it here. It's so alive and exciting. The town was even more alive than she realized, for there were new bar rooms by the dozens. Prostitutes following the army swarmed the town, and bawdy houses were blossoming with women to the consternation of the church people. Every hotel, boarding house, and private residence was crammed with visitors who had come to be near wounded relatives in the big Atlanta hospitals. There were parties and balls and bazaars every week, and war weddings without number. With the grooms on furlough in bright gray and gold braid, and the brides in blockade-run finery, aisles of crossed swords, toasts drunk in blockaded champagne, and tearful farewells. Nightly, the dark tree-lined streets resounded with dancing feet. And from parlors tinkled pianos where soprano voices blended with those of soldier guests in the pleasing melancholy of "The Bugles Sang Truce." And "Your Letter Came, But Came Too Late." Plaintive ballads that brought exciting tears to soft eyes, which had never known the tears of real grief. As they progressed down the street, through the sucking mud, Scarlet bubbled over with questions and Peter answered them, pointing here and there with his whip, proud to display his knowledge.
"Dat air de arsenal. Yes'm. Dey keeps guns and sech like dare. No'm, dem dare ain't stores. Dey's blockade officers." "Law, Miss Scarlet, don't you know what blockade officers is? Dey's officers where furriners stay dat buys us Confederates cotton and ship it out of Charleston and Wilmington and ship us back gunpowder." "No'm, I ain't sure what kind of furriners dey is. Miss Pity, she say dey's English, but can't nobody understand a word dey says. Yes'm, 'tis powerful smoky, and de suit just ruinin' Miss Pity's silk curtains. It's from de foundry and de rolling mills. And de noise dey makes at night, can't nobody sleep. No'm, I can't stop for you to look around. I done promise Miss Pity I'll bring you straight home. Miss Scarlet, make your curtsy. Does Miss Merewether and Miss Elsing a bowin' to you?"
Scarlet vaguely remembered two ladies of those names who came from Atlanta to Terra to attend her wedding, and she remembered that they were Miss Pittypat's best friends. So she turned quickly where Uncle Peter pointed and bowed. The two were sitting in a carriage outside a dry goods store. The proprietor and two clerks stood on the sidewalk with armfuls of bolts of cotton cloth that they had been displaying. Mrs. Merewether was a tall, stout woman, and so tightly corseted that her bust jutted forward like the prow of a ship. Her iron-gray hair was eked out by a curled false fringe that was proudly brown and disdained to match the rest of her hair. She had a round, highly colored face, in which was combined good-natured shrewdness and the habit of command. Mrs. Elsing was younger, a thin, frail woman who had been a beauty, and about her there still clung a faded freshness, a dainty, imperious air. These two ladies, with a third, Mrs. Whiting, were the pillars of Atlanta. They ran the three churches to which they belonged, the clergy, the choirs, and the parishioners. They organized bazaars and presided over sewing circles. They chaperoned balls and picnics. They knew who made good matches and who did not, who drank secretly, who were to have babies and when. They were authorities on the genealogies of everyone who was anyone in Georgia, South Carolina, and Virginia, and did not bother their heads about the other states, because they believed that no one who was anybody ever came from states other than these three. They knew what was decorous behavior and what was not, and they never failed to make their opinions known. Mrs. Merewether at the top of her voice, Mrs. Elsing in an elegant die-away drawl, and Mrs. Whiting in a distressed whisper, which showed how much she hated to speak of such things. These three ladies disliked and distrusted one another as heartily as the first triumvirate of Rome, and their close alliance was probably for the same reason. "I told Pitty I had to have you in my hospital," called Mrs. Merewether, smiling. "Don't you go promising Mrs. Meade or Mrs. Whiting."
"I won't," said Scarlet, having no idea what Mrs. Merewether was talking about, but feeling a glow of warmth at being welcomed and wanted. "I hope to see you again soon."
The carriage ploughed its way farther, and halted for a moment to permit two ladies with baskets of bandages on their arms to pick precarious passages across the sloppy street on stepping stones. At the same moment, Scarlet's eye was caught by a figure on the sidewalk in a brightly colored dress, too bright for streetwear, covered by a paisley shawl with fringes to the heels. Turning, she saw a tall, handsome woman with a bold face and a mass of red hair, too red to be true. It was the first time she had ever seen any woman who she knew for certain had done something to her hair, and she watched her, fascinated.
"Uncle Peter, who is that?" she whispered.
"I don't know."
"You do, too, I can tell. Who is she?"
"Her name's Belle Watling," said Uncle Peter, his lower lip beginning to protrude.
Scarlet was quick to catch the fact that he had not preceded the name with Miss or Mrs.
"Who is she?"
"Miss Scarlet,"
said Peter darkly, laying a whip on the startled horse.
"Miss Pitty ain't gwine to like it. You asking questions that ain't none of your business. There's a parcel of no-count folks in this town now that it ain't no use talking about."
"Good heavens," thought Scarlet, reproved into silence. "That must be a bad woman."
She had never seen a bad woman before, and she twisted her head and stared after her until she was lost in the crowd. The stores in the new war buildings were farther apart now, with vacant lots between. Finally, the business section fell behind, and the residences came into view. Scarlet picked them out as old friends. The Leyden House, dignified and stately. The Bunnells, with little white columns and green blinds. The close-lipped red-brick Georgian home of the McClure family, behind its low box hedges. Their progress was slower now, for from porches and gardens and sidewalks ladies called to her. Some she knew slightly, others she vaguely remembered, but most of them she knew not at all. Pitypat had certainly broadcast her arrival. Little Wade had to be held up time and again, so that ladies who ventured as far through the ooze as their carriage blocks could exclaim over him. They all cried to her that she must join their knitting and sewing circles, and their hospital committees, and no one else's. And she promised recklessly to right and left. As they passed a rambling green clapboard house, a little black girl posted on the front steps cried, "Here is she come!" And Dr. Mead and his wife and little 13-year-old Phil emerged, calling greetings. Scarlet recalled that they, too, had been at her wedding. Mrs. Mead mounted her carriage block and craned her neck for a view of the baby, but the doctor, disregarding the mud, ploughed through to the side of the carriage. He was tall and gaunt, and wore a pointed beard of iron gray, and his clothes hung on his spare figure as though blown there by a hurricane. Atlanta considered him the root of all strength and all wisdom, and it was not strange that he had absorbed something of their belief. But for all his habit of making oracular statements and his slightly pompous manner, he was as kindly a man as the town possessed. After shaking her hand and prodding Wade in the stomach and complimenting him, the doctor announced that Aunt Pitypat had promised on oath that Scarlet should be on no other hospital and bandage-rolling committee save Mrs. Mead's. "Oh, dear! But I've promised 1,000 ladies already," said Scarlet. "Mrs. Merriweather, I'll be bound," cried Mrs. Mead indignantly. "Drat the woman! I believe she meets every train." "I promised because I hadn't a notion what it was all about," Scarlet confessed. "What are hospital committees, anyway?" Both the doctor and his wife looked slightly shocked at her ignorance. "But, of course, you've been buried in the country and couldn't know," Mrs. Mead apologized for her. "We have nursing committees for different hospitals and for different days. We nurse the men and help the doctors and make bandages and clothes. And when the men are well enough to leave the hospitals, we take them into our homes to convalesce till they are able to go back in the army. And we look after the wives and families of some of the wounded who are destitute. Yes, worse than destitute. Dr. Mead is at the Institute Hospital where my committee works, and everyone says he's marvelous and—"
"There, there, Mrs. Mead," said the doctor fondly. "Don't go bragging on me in front of folks. It's little enough I can do since you wouldn't let me go in the army."
"Wouldn't let?" she cried indignantly. "Me? The town wouldn't let you, and you know it. Why, Scarlet, when folks heard he was intending to go to Virginia as an army surgeon, all the ladies signed a petition begging him to stay here. Of course, the town couldn't do without you."
"There, there, Mrs. Mead," said the doctor,
basking obviously in the praise.
"Perhaps with one boy at the front, that's enough for the time being."
"And I'm going next year," cried little Phil, hopping about excitedly. "As a drummer boy. I'm learning how to drum now. Do you want to hear me? I'll run get my drum."
"No, not now," said Mrs. Mead, drawing him closer to her, a sudden look of strain coming over her face. "Not next year, darling. Maybe the year after."
"But the war will be over then," he cried petulantly, pulling away from her. "And you promised."
Over his head, the eyes of the parents met, and Scarlet saw the look.
Darcy Mead was in Virginia, and they were clinging closer to the little boy that was left. Uncle Peter cleared his throat.
Miss Pitty were in